You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The school year is rapidly approaching, and districts everywhere are racing to figure out, how do you do this? How do you resume learning again amid a pandemic? Milwaukee Public Schools announced this week it would start the school year online, with students gradually returning to class once the threat of COVID-19 has subsided. What do you want your school district to do this fall? In person, virtual, a hybrid mix of the two? Are you worried about learning loss and summer slide after schools abruptly went remote in March? Join in here, 800-642-1234. Alan Borsuk is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University. He writes a weekly column on education for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he was reporter and editor for more than 35 years. Alan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
I'm glad to be here.
What is on the table right now? What are the options that school districts are weighing about how to approach education in the fall?
Well, to be honest, everything is on the table and nothing is nailed down. It is, the greatly overused word of the last few months, unprecedented. This is really, really unprecedented. I mean, it's the middle of July and it's hard to picture what's going to happen in any school and school district in the country. So the variety is enormous. I was just looking a few minutes ago at a list that Education Week is keeping of the largest districts in the country, what they're doing, and it's all over the place. A few, and only a few, are planning to return 5 days a week to school. Many are trying to do what they're calling a hybrid program of maybe a couple of days a week in school and the rest online. A number of really big districts, including Los Angeles, which is the second largest district in the country, are planning to indefinitely continue with all virtual learning. Around here, MPS says it's going to start virtual, although the official decision is scheduled to be made tonight at a Milwaukee school board meeting. And the suburbs around Milwaukee, I think statewide, it's pretty much all over the place. A few are trying to return 5 days a week in person, but the majority are, who knows what they're, you know, this mix of things, which just raises an unbelievable number of questions as to how it's going to happen.
And how do we, where do we even start with all of these questions? As these districts watch the cases increasing day to day, they watch those trend lines, they're trying to make these contingency plans. How do you even start doing that as a district in trying to figure out how to deliver your curriculum?
Well, I'd go back to the question you posed as we were starting this segment to address to parents, saying, what do you want for your kids? I think there's going to be a lot of priority on parents making their own decisions as best as they can of how to handle issues for their kids. For one thing, a lot of schools are going to give options of coming to school, not coming to school, coming a couple of days a week. So the pressure, and it is a pressure, it's many cases, frankly, it's a crisis for parents, is very intense. From the standpoint of schools, am I glad I'm not a school superintendent. Just you start thinking about the issues, and it's not just, obviously, health is the dominant issue. You know, nobody wants to do anything that's not safe for kids or adults, which, you know, schools are full of adults too, teachers and all the other staff. And that's a huge issue in itself, is whether the adults will come to school, whether there'll be enough teachers showing up. But in any case, the issues just keep multiplying. How do you get kids to school if you're a busing dependent district? How do you handle food? How do you handle bathrooms? How do you handle hallway passing? How do you handle just handling books or mask policies? And I would emphasize something that doesn't get enough attention, but is so crucial to a successful school and a successful school year for kids, which is all the intangibles. How do you build a culture within a classroom? How do you build the relationships between teachers and kids and between kids and kids when all this tangible stuff is so formidable? And this is a worst case scenario in that the surge of cases is coming at exactly the wrong time. I think everyone was hoping there'd at least be some decline from the peaks in April and so on. But everything's just getting tougher and tougher.
We're talking with Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette, looking at the decisions that school districts will have to make soon about how to educate students in the fall amid a pandemic. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Alan, in March, when schools abruptly turned to remote learning, has there been any data collection or understanding of what that switch and whether any of that curriculum sunk in for students or any type of research on what the impact of remote learning was early on in the pandemic?
Well, yes and no. Accountability systems like Wisconsin's statewide testing system totally went out the window. So there isn't the kind of data on a big picture that you'd like. On the other hand, there is enough emerging results and research from around the country to make some pretty definite conclusions, which is that it was a lesser system for everybody. It just wasn't working. But unfortunately, it's pretty clear that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, that the kids who are most in need in the lower performing brackets, lower income, lower everything, I mean, the have-nots of our economy and so on, were the ones who were hurt the most, had the biggest losses. And the people who had parents and such who had the resources to have decent connectivity at home, who basically had there's definitely a correlation. I saw a study a couple of days ago. Homes where the parents had high educational attainment were the ones that where the kids lost the least, and the ones where the parents had lesser educational attainment were the homes where the kids lost the most. So you had a big spring slide, even at the top of the scale. You had a summer slide, and now I'm afraid you're going to have a fall slide because the start of the school year is going to be so shaky. And overall, there's just no way the research that does exist doesn't spell out a major loss in learning nationwide and the worst for the neediest.
Well, connectivity aside, and just for students getting online, the practicality of when parents are working and the older siblings suddenly are thrust into caring for the younger children in the household, and there isn't an ability to study and to learn and to, do those assignments. What are you going to do there if it is online again and those parents need to work?
That is a huge question. I think, like I said, there's just so many layers to this. There's been a huge loss in daycare availability. Many early childhood centers have closed. The circumstances for many parents are going to be really, really difficult here. And for a lot of parents, there was a study that came out a week ago or so nationwide that said that parents, number one, thought their kids had not done very well as far as learning in the spring, but number two, were very forgiving of their school district, let's say, or felt their school districts had done a good job of responding. Well, it was an emergency. It was a nationwide crisis. It was a pandemic. Going into this fall, I don't think people will be and probably should not be quite as understanding and forgiving. I think they should really be advocating for what can be done best for their kids. And in very few cases, they do exist, but in very few cases, is that going to be as good at home as it is in a classroom?
Alan Borsuk with us, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette. What's been the effect of remote learning on your child? Do you have a special needs student? Were you able to make progress with their IEP? What setbacks did your child experience in trying to follow the remote learning curriculum? We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we talk about fall classes, how schools will make progress with students. Even before COVID, learning loss was a problem worldwide, with about half of children in low and middle income countries living in what's called learning poverty, being unable to read and understand simple text by age 10. It's according to the World Bank. We're asking about the growing achievement gaps intensified by the pandemic with your insights here, 800-642-1234. Alan Borsuk is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette, longtime education reporter, and he's our guide this hour. Let's bring in a call now. Brad is with us from Mauston. Hi, Brad.
Good morning. I'm trying to find out in regards to this whole kids returning to school situation. Is anybody doing anything to evaluate what kind of psychological harm, both short-term and long-term, there may be to these kids coming back into such an unusual environment?
Brad, thank you for that. Alan, what does the trauma look like?
Well, I don't know of any data on that, but I think there's a across the board an agreement that this is a huge challenge on a bunch of levels for just about any child, perhaps for about any parent. This is a social and emotional wound, just a really tough situation. And schools are going to have to really pitch in to help with the social emotional state of kids. At the same time, it's going to be harder than ever to do that because of everything, social distancing and masks and flip-flop schedules and so on. So that's for all kids. Then you could certainly have a proportion of kids, a significant proportion of kids who have major social, emotional problems, mental issues. I mean, long before the coronavirus came along, the rise of concern among school officials across Wisconsin, not only in the high poverty districts, when it came to the mental health of kids, was very, very substantial and growing, which is why some spending in the state budget on mental health to kids has increased. And that's just going to be worse than ever. I mean, this, like I said, it just takes your breath away to think about how many dimensions there are to the issues here. And for kids with special education needs, kids who are perhaps English language learners, kids who come from very troubled homes, really unstable living circumstances, kids who are homeless. All of these are substantial groups of children who are even more impacted. Providing special education services in schools this fall is going to be really, really big challenge, even more, obviously more so than for regular education kids.
Alan, what do schools need on, what do schools need on the federal level in this crisis?
Well, I don't want to say anything that's too shocking, but it's been a little bit unsteady in the vision that's coming down from federal officials, starting with the president and the Secretary of Education. So they really haven't provided either clarity or very much help. What do schools need? Well, they certainly don't need funding to be cut, which is what the president said a couple weeks ago. I think here's another shocking thought. It's not actually going to happen the way he said it. This is very expensive. All this stuff. You just think about extra cleaning and extra buses and spreading out classes by social distancing requires more teachers, more, just everything is very expensive. Millions and millions of dollars just for masks and cleaning supplies. MPS estimated the other day that the bill for this year will be $90 million in addition to the rest of the budget. That's pushing 10% of their budget, and they're probably underestimating it. So what do the schools need? Yeah, they need money. I think that's true for every school, big districts, little districts, private, public, you name it. So, but they need clarity. They need stability. They need some sense of everyone getting on the same page. And instead, and this isn't just a federal problem, but it is that too, we've got this very fractured, polarized, politicized environment, which, you kind of want to say, can't everybody come together around figuring out what's good for education? Isn't this a unifying subject? No, it's been a very divisive subject.
We're with Alan Borsuk, senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University. We're exploring the choices that school districts are faced with about how to educate students in the fall amid a pandemic, and taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Scott now in Spring Valley. Hi, Scott.
Yeah, the only way to control epidemics in this country is through massive testing and quarantine. And since the Trump administration has failed that miserably, we have no control of this virus, and that's pretty obvious. We're by far number one in the world in deaths. And so what we should be calling for is, what a lot of epidemiologists are calling for, is 10 million tests a week throughout this country. So until we do this, it is ludicrous to send these children back to school. And let's be clear that in the fall and early winter, when the flu season hits, this is going to get much worse.
Scott,
so because we failed miserably, we cannot send these children back to school. And until we get a policy of how to control epidemics, which is massive testing and quarantine.
Scott, in as a tangent to what you're saying there, Alan, are schools looking at any type of testing protocol types of massive testing undertaking at schools?
Well, there may be some, particularly the independent or private schools, that will require testing or whatever. I think that's more than a public school system can get involved in, but there will be a lot of monitoring. I suspect a lot of schools will have policies where they take everybody's temperature on the way in the door in the morning, where masks are required even for down to, oh, maybe say third grade, kids below third grade, that may not be so easy. They're setting up classrooms with social distancing, setting up cafeterias and buses and so on. I'm not a medical expert, that's for sure, but I do defer to the experts. And that is the ultimate, really troubling aspect of this, of the conflict between what's necessary to fight the pandemic and what's actually good for education, which is to get everybody back together. The American Academy of Pediatrics, which is the major group of pediatricians in the country, issued a statement, must be about 3 weeks ago now, saying they thought that it was possible to get kids back in school safely, that especially among young kids, transmission was not as big a problem as feared, and that 3 to 6 feet distancing was okay, and that the social-emotional sides of what kids need were being undermined by keeping them at home. So that was kind of surprising. So you have experts on all sides, it's going to be very tough to navigate the conflict between health imperatives and education imperatives.
Scott, thanks for the call. Let's bring in Catherine now in Elm Grove with thoughts on this. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm an educator, and I've been working with a group of retired educators. We have, probably 1,000 years experience among the group. As we were talking about this over the last few months, we started with a plan to help maybe offer guidelines to districts to implement social distancing and things that would help. And we just met again yesterday, and we've decided, and this is what I'm sharing with you, is we are still in the pandemic. So basically, as a country, we are still in fight or flight. And as any psychologist would tell you, don't make a decision when you're in fight or flight. You're in survival mode. And survival mode is not the time to bring back something and try to fit a round peg into a square hole. And that's what we feel they're rushing to the start line, because the start line was always August or September. And I think all bets are off the table now, and we should take a pause, and we should use this opportunity to recalibrate education. What was going well? What wasn't going so well? What was working for students in urban areas? What was working for students in other areas? Where were the inequities? Let's take this time to analyze that and bring back education when it can come back, in person, to a better, stronger institution. It's one of the many institutions in our country that has revealed many of its dysfunctions during the pandemic. And this rush to mitigate supplies and logistics is really going to have serious repercussions, as well as huge implications for the institution. So we're going to take a breaking or broken institution and put it into the worst scenario of its life.
Catherine,
so the rush to do this is not prudent.
Catherine, thank you for bringing this as an educator and exploring this in fight or flight mode. We have Alan Borsuk here, senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette, longtime education writer at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the shock to education, the actions by districts, the recalibration Catherine suggests. What concerns do you have about your child missing out on social growth by not playing, being around other kids? Do you live in a rural area where internet access is spotty? How could remote learning be improved? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Alan Borsuk, maybe hear from you right after this news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're getting back into our conversation about education and what school might look like in the fall as educators worry about the most vulnerable students falling further behind. K-12 schools are struggling to find the best plan for the academic year when every single decision will come with consequences. What do you hope to see out of your district? What did you learn about your child as your school transitioned to remote learning last March? Would you send your kid back to school with a mask? Would you put them on the bus? Be part of this 800-642-1234. Alan Borsuk is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette. He stays with us. Alan, I want you to be able to respond to Catherine, an educator, as we went into the news break there. Catherine saying that we are in fight or flight mode. This is not the time to rush it. It's actually a time to recalibrate education.
Well, she's right and she's wrong. She's right in that anyone, I hope, would agree that there ought to be lessons to be learned from all of this about what's effective and how to structure schools. Maybe it's time to really figure out how to use computers in education and online learning and so on. I mean, in many ways, schools have made changes, but still fundamentally haven't changed in the new technology era. So all these long-term things are really valuable, but time marches on. I mean, it's the middle of July and you have to have school starting by roughly 6 weeks from now, 7 weeks from now. So decisions have to be made. There's an urgent short-term situation that cannot be ignored. You know, it's just not the right time to sit back and say, let's have a study commission. You know, it's just not going to happen.
Let's bring in another call now. Bruce is joining us from Holman. Hi, Bruce.
Hello. I'm a retired high school teacher with 33 years experience. I retired in 2010 at the age of 60, and it's been my experience that teachers are incredibly dedicated and caring people. That being said, there's a lot of talk about the safety of children, the safety of children's families, how to deal with children and masking and distancing. And I do understand that, and that is of primary importance. But I don't hear an awful lot about the safety of the teachers, and not just teachers, but the other adult staff. You know, doctors are dying, nurses are dying. What happens when teachers start getting coronavirus and dying? That's kind of my concern. Are teachers going to be willing to put themselves in danger? Are we going to be willing to endanger ourselves, our families, our parents, our grandparents, relatives, by going into infected schools, infected classrooms? How many teachers will just get out of the profession? What will happen if you refuse to come into a school? Can you be non-renewed? Will they tear up your contract? Will there be lawsuits if teachers are forced to teach in unsafe conditions? And as a high school teacher, I can tell you, and anybody who has teenagers knows, to try to get a room with 30 kids to all wear masks and all social distance, you can't do it. They're not going to do it. They might do it when you're standing right there watching them. But as soon as you turn your back, those masks are going in their pockets.
Bruce, you've brought up so many points. I want Alan to be able to start digging in here with the things that you're bringing up. Alan?
Well, I would be glad to let Bruce keep talking to the extent that I think these are really, really important points. And teachers and the national teachers unions have been deeply involved in advocacy on this on behalf of protecting teachers, which, you know, that draws some fire and it also draws some support. Nobody should be forced to go into circumstances that aren't healthy for them or threatening to them. And that includes absolutely all the adults in a school building. So yeah, if you open the school and the teachers don't show up, this is really going to be a problem. One of the huge conflicts here is that there have been attempts to assess this that have put the rate of the percentage of teachers who say they aren't planning to come back into a school building until they're convinced itself at quite high, 20% to 50%. And the conflict is you're probably going to need more adults in the building if you're going to operate it, because if you take a class of 30 and spread it out in your typical classroom, you're going to need two classrooms. And so you need two teachers, and you need all these extra people for cleaning. MPS, Milwaukee Public Schools, estimated a couple weeks ago they're going to need 215 additional people just to do cleaning every day within school buildings as school is going on. And that's just one function. So the whole question of can you get adults to show up is really, really crucial. And for all the reasons that Bruce was saying, including what do you do to a teacher who says, I don't feel safe coming in? Is that a punishable offense? Is it something you endorse? I think most districts will try to say, that's okay, we'll work it out. I saw a tweet yesterday from a national education writer who said, I'm confused. Are the teachers the heroes or the enemy today? Because there's been so much arguing over, you know, well, the heroes show up and you say, no, the heroes take care of themselves. Both are true.
We're talking with Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette, examining the difficult decisions that school districts must make about how to educate students in the fall amid a pandemic. With your thoughts on the table, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Mike now in Singer. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, my question is, do you have any idea of how many backup plans are out there in all the districts throughout the state and maybe throughout the country, but at least in the state of Wisconsin? If as your former call-in guest was just saying, what if the bodies start piling up? What do we do then? If what is the acceptable risk losing teachers and losing parents and losing grandparents and buses, for goodness sakes, in my district? Everybody's on a bus. What's the protocol for the busing?
Mike,
I mean, it's just such a complicated issue. Okay.
Yeah, Mike, thank you so much. And, you know, how do, Alan, districts negotiate risk? Or what have you seen in the past in terms of how they approach risk and what they can do?
I don't know if there is any past that's relevant here, because this is so unexplored turf and so freighted with big issues. But to a large degree, yeah, they're making it up as they go. And you've got a lot of districts that still, both the smaller districts in Wisconsin and huge national, huge districts in urban places around the country, every dimension, that just haven't really set a plan. And even those that have announced a plan say, but this is subject to change. I mean, we've had enormous number of shocking and unprecedented turns in the nature of American living in the last 6 months. What makes us think we've used up our supply of surprises, that there may be more difficult things coming along? As I said earlier, this surge of cases nationwide is coming at exactly the wrong time to try to reopen schools as if nothing was going on. So more and more, I think the pressure is going to be to open partially or to continue full-time virtual, at least for the next few months, if not for the entire next school year.
Let's bring in David, who is joining us from Richmond. Hi, David. What are your thoughts?
Hi. Say, I wanted to mention my wife works for Sanford Health Systems, and on one of their teleconference meetings this week, they were talking about the long-term effects of asymptomatic people, mild symptomatic, and hospitalized people. And they're looking at, they're going to be studying the long-term effects on people's bodies, whether they're symptomatic or not. And they're concerned that children might, even if they would test positive but not have any symptoms, as they age and become adults, that their hearts or lungs could be compromised. And they don't know that yet. So one of the nurses asked a doctor, how would you feel if your kids test positive? He said he would be very concerned. And since we don't know how this might affect your body in the future, it's opening a door that we don't know what's going to be behind it.
David, thank you. Alan, asymptomatic and children spreading, we've heard mixed messages there.
I'm not too bad at talking about education policy. I'm really bad at talking about medical policy and health policy. Yeah, there's just a huge number of unknown things here, and some of them are kind of frightening to think about.
David, thank you for bringing that. Joe is with us in Star Lake with comments. Joe, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm glad you're doing this program. We're up in Star Lake. We live in Washington State, but we come every summer and spend several months here in Wisconsin. And but I have a long history of working with schools in sort of innovative ways as an outside storyteller and musician. I also was the founder of a children's museum in West Virginia. So I have a lot of experience of organizations that develop programs that come into schools traditionally to enhance the education of children. I'm particularly passionate about history. And so I'm looking at what's going on right now and wondering how easily children will lose both maybe the knowledge of history, but also the interest in it, you know, be excited about knowing our story collectively as a people, and particularly in what's going on politically and culturally. I think this is a huge danger to children. So that's a long introduction, but the question is, any ideas how organizations or individuals who have done this work for years can sort of maybe transform what they're doing into distance learning that works, that's interactive, but brings these resources to the children that can be that the teachers can access and school districts can access?
Great question, Joe. We're going to get at it at the other side of this break. So many issues to work through as we discuss how school will take shape in the fall amid the pandemic. Alan Borsuk is a longtime education reporter, columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, senior fellow at Marquette. Is your child facing a milestone year when they need to turn things around to apply for college? Do you worry about a dip in education quality as educators ramp up their delivery of online lessons? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at education delivery, how districts are approaching fall classes. More than 50 million school kids in our country alone have spent months now out of class, away from friends, not working out problems at a desk with their teacher over their shoulder. And researchers have been studying how to prevent learning loss and what parents can do. Are you worried about your child falling behind in reading and math? Is your child expressing fear of COVID, dreading the idea of going back to school? What do you tell them? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Alan Borsuk, senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette, he stays with us. Alan, I want to address the last question there on how you transform the curriculum to make online learning accessible and to make that curriculum successful. How do you do that? And the caller was concerned about losing the interest in history.
Well, that's losing interest in history is a really interesting question since we're living through it so much. I mean, there are kids who have done great as being homeschooled. There are excellent programs, at least they have reputations of being excellent, out there for distance learning, some of which have pretty high profiles, like Khan Academy. Nonetheless, on a mass scale, which is what everyone was forced into back in March, no one was prepared for this, and the effectiveness, I don't think you could find anyone in the education world anywhere that would said, we didn't miss a beat. Everyone missed a beat, and they missed many, many beats in many cases. And as I said before, mostly involving the kids who most needed to keep the beat going. So in the long run, are there ways to improve it? Will things be better this fall than they were in the spring? Because districts and schools and individual teachers have had time to prep for what they can do in distance learning and online learning. Yes. Is it going to be great? No one's gotten that far. Got one other interesting issue, troubling issue for this fall. At least last spring, when things changed so abruptly, teachers and students had a relationship that had 6 months down for that year. And so teachers knew and students knew each other. This fall, in many, many cases, you're going to have a new school year, new teachers and new kids, and a lot of trouble establishing relationships, whether it's in school with all the rules on distancing and sanitary practices and so on, or online. So that relationships, which are so hugely important in successful education, are going to be really tough to establish this fall in many cases.
I know my young twins are just longing to see their kindergarten teacher and to think that they'll have a new teacher next year who they haven't established that relationship with is disheartening to them, I think. And also it causes more dread and worry perhaps about what that, you know, that COVID is to them.
Well, let me try not to be entirely gloomy. Just last night, I was somewhere where someone pulled out a book called Grit by a University of Pennsylvania professor named Angela Duckworth. And yeah. I've read that book, and I'm pretty familiar with the whole grit thinking. I thought, man, now there's something we're really going to benefit from. Parents, kids, teachers, you name it. This whole resiliency and grit and the need to rise to the occasion. There are many, many people, both adults and kids, who will do that. And kids especially are resilient. So is there hope? Yeah. Is the challenge going to be really, really great? Yes. So rising to that occasion and say, you know, well, your twins, maybe they'll meet their next teacher and really hit it off and say, you know, it's a new day and we're really making the best of things. The parents who make the best of things for their kids, who really are smart, on top of it, advocates who are creating home environments that are best for their kids. Those are the ones who I think have the best chance of seeing their kids navigate this extremely difficult period in the best shape.
In the months after remote learning, so much also was looking at the homeschooling model. How do homeschoolers do it? And there was, you know, sudden this burst of interest in how is homeschooling effective? What can we learn from that model?
Well, my guess is the best answer is that it's not as simple as it looks. You know, all of us went through probably at least 13 years of schooling from kindergarten through 12th grade and saw teachers every day. So we all think we know how to be teachers because there's like no job in the world that people have watched being done more than teaching. And that's just not true. It's not easy. So the most effective homeschoolers are and the parents in those situations are making very careful and good choices. It's not like you get up in the morning and say, well, what should we do today? You really need to be on top of it. And not many people are capable of that. I think an awful lot of parents found in the spring that for days 1 through 5, they were maybe feeling like they were doing okay as teachers. But for days 6 and the next 100 days, it wasn't so good. And I think a lot of parents are feeling kind of maxed out as teachers. And have perhaps a lot more respect now for actual teachers than they had before, because it's not an easy job. So Let's all become homeschoolers is actually not a very practical or good answer.
Ellen Borsick, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette. We're exploring the choices that school districts are faced with about how to educate students in the fall and getting your ideas as well. Matt from Wausau emailed to say this virus literally infected the entire planet in 8 months. And Matt says there's absolutely no way to open schools safely. The people of Wisconsin cannot be inconvenienced to wear masks. So Matt says, I, for one, won't be sending my daughter to in-person schooling until there is an enforced mask-wearing mandate. And as you've been mentioning there, it is perhaps difficult, and other callers have said, difficult to enforce masks on children, and also the fear factor.
The fear factor, now that's a really important aspect. I mean, obviously there are really, really serious reasons to take this all seriously, the whole COVID-19 impact. On the other hand, there are many people who are frankly probably going a little bit beyond where they need to be. And until people are comfortable, I mean, you can order anything you want. You can order everyone to come back to school even. If they're not going to do it, they're not going to do it. And whether that's a restaurant or a school or a who knows what, if people are not feeling safe out there, that has huge impact. And that's true for teachers, students, in any setting. So the fear factor is really, really important. And I don't think it's subsided. I think there's still a lot of people who are deeply worried about what the impact will be if they go back out into the world.
Alan, how should we be talking with our kids about COVID-19?
Despite all that's going on, I'm in favor of being as positive as possible, that we're going to keep running a good home and being a family together, that we're going to try to keep doing positive things, that we're confident in our own personal qualities and the importance. And at the same time, not lying about stuff. I mean, not sugarcoating what's going on and why we're staying home. A friend of mine posted a tweet the other day that her 2-year-old was reading a Clifford the Red Dog book and was upset that the owner wasn't washing her hands when they came home. So kids can really get used to a lot. So being honest, open, obviously concerned, but also trying to be positive and constructive, I think that'll pay off in the long run.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Glad to do it. I hope this is helpful.
Alan Borsick is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University. He writes a weekly column on education for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he was reporter and editor for more than 35 years. Just ahead, it is On Point. Why are police officers taught to expect danger? Police officers are taught to expect danger on the job. A sociologist says that expectation might be a root cause of police brutality. On Point, we'll explore that. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.